This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello and welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology, and today I'm talking to Dr. Duncan Law, a consultant clinical psychologist with over 25 years' experience across the NHS, higher education institutes and voluntary sectors. Duncan is a consultant clinical associate at the Anna Freud National Centre for Children and Families. He has a particular interest in better collaborative practice, shared decision-making and working with goals in therapy, and he'll be presenting at the Making Child and Family Therapies More Effective inaugural Judy Dunn National Conference, which takes place on November the 9th in Manchester. Hi, Duncan.
Hello.
Duncan, can you say a little about yourself by way of an introduction?
I'm a consultant clinical psychologist, worked for 20-odd years in mostly in Hertfordshire in the NHS in a fantastic team in East Hearts, then moved over to the Anna Freud National Centre for Children and Families, which is a national children's mental health charity. I work here a day and a half a week, but do other things, work with an organisation called Changing Minds, and do a lot of work with a great organisation called Common Room, which is an organisation that employs young people and young adults with direct experience of mental health services to make sure that children's voices are in training, research, policy. Mm-hmm. And I'm a trustee of MAC UK, which is another children's mental health charity.
And how did you become interested in this field?
When I started, I won't get into, it was years of psychotherapy to explain why I kind of got into psychology, but in terms of why children, when I started my clinical training, my intention was always to work with adults. Mm. And then when I started working with adults, I kind of felt this is too late. You know, there's the problems have started, you know, years ago. And we know now, I didn't know then, but we know now that 75% of long-term mental health problems start before the age of 25. So then I moved into working with children when I qualified and started working in an inpatient unit. And then I felt this is too late. If by the time young people are in inpatient units, we've missed huge opportunities. So then moved into the community. And now I'm kind of thinking, even that's too late. We need to kind of move to a much more preventative model, which will stop the kind of issues which lead to mental health problems starting. So I've kind of been on this journey, getting earlier and earlier and earlier.
How far back should one be going?
At least to their grandparents. Well, how far back? It's about how wide we go, really, I think, rather than how far back. So it's about what level do we work at? So traditional child mental health models have been working with the individual and maybe with the family. I think we've kind of moved in a really helpful direction to think about working with schools. But I'm really interested with a kind of group of other people to think about how we work with whole communities and how we intervene as psychologists, I guess, at a political level as well. So we know that social deprivation has an enormous impact on mental health, probably doubles the prevalence. So if we can start tackling social inequality, then maybe we're doing much more good for young people and families and the whole community than if we just work with one person or one family at a time.
Okay. Coming back to your clinical work, you've stressed the importance of having a good therapeutic alliance in achieving positive outcomes. I'm assuming that means an alliance between the therapist and the child or young person. I expect it could also mean with the parents or carers. How do you set about achieving that alliance?
Well, that's an interesting one. Anyone who's done a psychological therapist training or psychotherapy, a large part of that training will be about how do you kind of create a good therapeutic alliance? And yet what's really interesting, despite all that emphasis and training, what we find is that actually creating a good alliance between the therapist and the young person, or therapist and the family, whoever you're working with, there's not much of a correlation. The therapists aren't very good at spotting or being able to say whether the young person or the family they're working with feels that they are in alliance with that therapist. So despite all the training, we're not very good at it. How do you go about setting up a good therapeutic alliance? I mean, it's about the person that you're working with feeling that you're on their side and helping them get to where they want to go to, or get what they want out of the kind of work that you might be doing together. So we know that there are certain things that kind of add up to a good therapeutic alliance. So does the young person feel that you're listening to them? Do they feel they have a voice in what's being said? Do they feel that the things that you're doing are helpful for them to get to where they want to be? Does this feel like the right kind of thing that might be helpful? And those sorts of things explain a large part of the variance in terms of therapy outcomes. Depending on whose research literature you believe, it might be the alliance that's the best predictor of change. Others might say it's a particular therapeutic model, but the jury's out on that. But actually, one of the things that creates the biggest difference in terms of therapeutic alliance is whether the person that you're working with feels that you're working with them towards whatever goal they have to get out of the work that you're doing together. Mm-hmm. So goals, we know, are part of one of the things. Agreed goals, collaboratively agreed goals, are one of the things that actually create good therapeutic alliance, and good therapeutic alliance is one of the best predictors of therapy outcome.
And who creates the goals? Who are the main parties in this collaboration? Is it driven by you? Is it the young person you're working with?
Both. So it has to be collaborative. So it gets complicated with children, and the younger the child, the more complicated it gets. So if we start at the easy end, with older adolescents who are kind of gillick competent, very, you know, they can kind of decide for themselves whether this is something that they feel that they want, then you would hear from the young person about their kind of story, about what's brought them to meet with you. And then throughout, as you're hearing that story, at some point it may become very obvious that this is the young person says, and actually this is what I want to get out from this. Or it might be kind of picking out bits from the story when they tell about the sorts of things that I feel might be helpful, sort of to summarise. But at some point in the conversation, you know, you ask the young person, you know, what is it you want? Right. What do you want? And I think we often forget that in therapy. So we kind of come with very well-researched, clever models about how to help. But we I think, sometimes fall short of really asking the young person whether is this thing the thing that you really want help with? So with older adolescents, for them to tell us and for us to kind of shape it together. So what is it you want? And often that's a difficult question to answer, because young people, therapy is an unusual business. You don't know what you might be allowed to ask for. So you've got to, this is where the collaboration comes in, about saying, well, these are the sorts of things that might be helpful. This is what I've heard you say, which I think might be what you're saying that you might want some help with. And then you've got to think whether what the young person wants fits with what you're able to offer and the context of the organisation that you're working in, and also whether what the young person wants is safe. Right. There are very clear examples where a young person might say what they want and it's very clear that it's not safe. So young person with eating issues who might already be severely underweight, and if you ask them what do you want, they might say, well, I want to lose more weight, or I want to exercise more. And those would be clearly unsafe goals. And I think the role of the practitioner is to sort of help the young person, or work with the young person. This can be a long-term piece of work, to get to the point where there's some overlap between what the young person wants and what the therapist and the context that they're working in, it feels, is safe and acceptable.
And what might be an example of the type of goals? I mean, obviously you can't talk about individual cases, but what are the type of... a typical type of goal, that a safe goal that...
Yeah. I think they fall into three categories. So the most obvious ones are sort of change orientated goals. So there's something that's happening to me now. I'm experiencing something. I don't want to experience this anymore. I want it to be different. So it might be can't get out of bed in the morning, which stops me going to school, which stops me meeting with my friends, which stops me having a social life. And so the young person's goal might be, I want to have a better social life, or I want to be able to get out of bed in the morning. Very rarely in my experience do young people say, I want help with my low mood, or I want help with my depression or anxiety. Young people don't fret. That's professional language.
So it's more pragmatic.
It's more pragmatic about the things that young people want to get on with their lives and the things that are important to them in their lives. So there's those kind of change-orientated goals. And then there's what we might call learning goals. So things that might not create immediate change, but might really help the young person or the family feel either more confident in what they're doing, or that they've got resources which might help over time manage and create change. And we're working with this a lot with the new children wellbeing practitioner. So this is with children wellbeing practitioners. They are trained in what we call guided self-help. So you help the family or the young person help themselves. You offer them resources which are tried and tested in terms of, you know, there's a belief that they'll be helpful, and you see whether the family can, you guide them and coach them to work in that particular way. So what you're actually offering is not therapeutic change in that time that you're meeting with them, but you're offering them resources, learning, which might be helpful once you stop meeting, that might then lead to behaviour change. And then I think the third category, and this is, so I've been doing a lot of work with Mick Cooper, who's professor of counselling psychology at Roehampton University. And we found ourselves kind of arguing around the sorts of goals that people set. And actually we realised that actually just the different context that we work in and we're coming from. And this third category emerged about what we might call exploration goals. So the goal might not be to learn something which might lead to change, or to work on something which definitely leads to change. It might be, you know, I want to explore. I want to explore myself. I want to explore kind of by having conversations with people, a therapist or a counsellor, which might not have a kind of direct destination. Mm-hmm. It's more about travel. It's travel for, you know, you're kind of exploring a country rather than trying to head to a particular destination.
You talked about the outcomes when you're working with a young person who has good verbal skills and is old enough to understand about goal setting. What happens if you're working with very young children? Yeah. How do you set goals then?
Well, I think what we should always try and do is to hear the young person's voice, however young they are. And I think there's issues with, it gets more difficult the younger the person is. It gets difficult in services that work with people with learning disabilities, particularly if they don't have sort of verbal skills. But I think it's really important we should try and get an idea about what the young person might want to change and might want to be different. So you've got to adapt the language and the ways of communicating to sort of fit with the person that you're working with. So with younger children, you know, you adopt your language. There's people who do great work using visual cues to younger people to get an idea about what they want and what they might want to be different in their lives. But if we're working directly with a young person, I think this is part of kind of the consent process. I think it's really important that they have an idea about, why am I going to meet with this strange person and do this kind of strange thing week after week? Mm. They've got to have some idea about what they hope will be different. The process of getting there is different. The kind of the sophistication is kind of different, but the process, I think, has to be the same.
Right. Tell me about the goals-based outcome, the GBO tool. How did it come about, and how does it work?
I mean, it's a very clinical tool. So there are sort of, I think, kind of two categories of outcome measures. Don't like that language, but it's the kind of language that's used. There's the ones that come from the research fields where they're really good, sophisticated tools tend to be quite sort of a long battery of questions which are really good at differentiating kind of one problem from another. And then there's another set of tools which grow out of things that are helpful to do clinically, which are less standardized, have less kind of robust psychometric properties, but are really useful as clinical tools. And you can get data from them as well, which is helpful. And the goal-based outcome tool is very much grew out of a clinical tool. So it grew from reminding practitioners that I work with in the team that I worked in to set goals with families. So we realised this was a really good idea, but we weren't doing it quite as well as we wanted to, or we were kind of thought we were, but we weren't kind of indicating enough to families that actually we're setting goals with you now. We're having a very kind of discreet conversation about what you might want from coming and working with us. So it was a piece of paper which just said, don't forget to set goals. And then we thought, actually, we can be a bit more sophisticated with this. And if we've got families setting goals, wouldn't it be good to try and measure whether what we were doing with them, they felt, was actually being helpful? And what the goal-based outcome tool does is, it arguably, it measures the most important thing, which is, are we helping you with the things that are most important to you? So we know there's a correlation between the goal-based outcome tool and more standardized measures like the strengths and difficulties questionnaire. But there are points where goal-based outcome tool picks up things which symptom-based questionnaires just you would see no change. And I think it's because it gets back to these sort of learning goals we talked about earlier. Families might feel that you're being really helpful to them in giving them ideas about how to manage their child. So I'm just thinking about a child with autism spectrum disorder and a parent who might, you know, feel that am I kind of parenting my child in the right way? I mean, it's a question we all have as parents, but I think it's particularly pertinent with parents of children with ASD. You're very unlikely to see symptom change in a short piece of work around ASD. But what you might do is the family's goal might be to try and, I want to understand my child better so that I can be a better parent. You might do a really good piece of work with that parent, which helps them feel much more confident as a parent. They may not do anything different, but they just recognise that actually what they're doing is the best thing to do. You might not see any symptom change, so tools like the SDQ won't show a difference, but you've been really helpful clinically in helping that family kind of take a big step towards what they would want in life and the life of their child.
So just to be clear, these are personalised rather than standardised?
They are ideographic and ipsative, which causes all sorts of problems to statisticians, and it's causing problems currently with the Mental Health Services data set. So the goal-based outcome tool is part of the Mental Health Services data set. NHS England recognise that it's really important to capture the thing that's most important to the family, not just about symptom change, but because it's ideographic, so everyone's goals are different, and that's kind of the purpose and the point of it. It's hard to say what you're picking up on. And it's ipsative, so that means that you're comparing the change to where the person was before. So if you start at 1 out of 10, so it's a zero, simple 0 to 10 scale. If you start at 1 out of 10, for one person that moves to 5 out of 10, well, it's a shift in the right direction, but does that mean for someone else who moves from 1 to 5 that you're measuring the same distance of travel? And you're probably not. Mm-hmm. So I think it's NHS England are sort of wrestling with this, and I think it's great that they are. And I think we have to find ways of capturing the things that are most important to families rather than the things that are sort of straightforward to measure and interpret. It's problematic, but I think that's also its strength, that you're working on the things that are most important to the family and you're measuring what's really important to that? Am I helping you with the thing that's most important? I think that's, however much training we've had, however clever the kind of theories are that we use, however kind of esteemed the organisation we work in, it counts for nothing unless families and young people say that what we're doing is actually making a positive difference to their lives.
Right. The title of your talk is How Using Personalised Goals in Therapy Will Change Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you to sort of sell that concept to me. Why is it so valuable, and how does it benefit the child and family, but also how does it make the therapist's job easier, make your clinical work more effective?
What we've tried to do with the tool is to kind of create a way of capturing that work and also encouraging and facilitating people to have those collaborative conversations with the people that they're working with. We know it makes a difference. So we know that working collaboratively around goals, all the work that's been done on therapeutic alliance says that if you've got good therapeutic alliance, you're less likely to have dropout from therapy, and the work that you do is more likely to lead to a better outcome. So in a time when we're resource poor in child mental health services, it's always been that way. There's never been a time when mental health services, particularly children's mental health services, have had the resource that they need. I think what we know now is just the enormity of that gap. Mm. So even by the government's own ambition, it will be to have 35% of children with a moderate to severe sort of mental health difficulty that would be reach a diagnostic level. The government's initiative is to be able to have 35% of those kids being seen by a mental health professional. The vast majority, well, what will they get? There's no answer to that. So we know that there's an enormous gap between the resource that's going in and the need that's out there. And that was based on very old prevalence data from the turn of the last century. The emerging prevalence data suggests that actually it might be six times the needs that we felt these current statistics are based on. Certainly there's a growing increase in young people and families recognising mental health problems and sort of kind of self-identifying as someone with a mental health need in a way and that's the latest data says it's six times more than it was 20 years ago when the last prevalence data came out. So there's a growing demand, and there's arguably a slightly increasing resource. So we have to be really mindful about how we use the very precious and limited resource that we have. And that means, whether we like it or not, and I hope we like it because I think it benefits families as well, we've got to do the stuff which is the most effective and quickest way of helping families kind of get on their way and letting them get on with it. So anything that helps with that, anything that kind of speeds up the work that we do to help families kind of and young people improve or get back on track, the better. Therapeutic alliance is one of the really strong predictors of that, and setting collaborative goals is one of the really strong predictors of a good therapeutic alliance.
Can goals-based outcomes be used across all the therapeutic modalities, or is it best suited for the more solution-based interventions like CBT?
I think it's a matter of fit. So it can be used across all therapeutic modalities. So basically what it says is ask the person what they want, where do you want to get to, how you get them there, that's entirely up to you and them. You know, you choose the best approach to get them to where they want to be. So in that respect, it can be used, and I think ought to be used across all therapeutic, but that conversation has to be used. And this is about, for me, it's about informed consent, and it's about participation. We've just written a paper with colleagues from Common Room, which with some young people with lived experience of mental health services, and one of them came up with this phrase, I think it's fantastic. It's about, they call it everyday participation. So participation in child mental health is often seen as you get a focus group, you get a group of young people who will at best start to shape mental health services. But if you ask people to be involved in the intervention, the therapeutic work that you're doing with them, every session or moment by moment, then they're participating in a really live way every day, every time that you meet with them. And I think it's a really nice idea and a really strong way of bringing young people's voice into therapy. So does it fit with every model? I think it has to. The questions have to be asked. Otherwise, you're not doing informed consent and you're not really hearing the voice of young people in therapy. Does it have to be used every time you meet with a young person? I think the jury's out on that. The research evidence isn't strong enough to say whether that is the thing that makes a difference or not.
I suppose this relates to informed consent, but who do you share the information, the outcome information that's measured? Who do you share that with? Are you sharing that with commissioners, peers?
I mean, that's up to the service, who they share it with. And I think you share it with whoever it's helpful to share it with, and you share it in a way that's helpful to share. So we know there are some young people who like to see the kind of charts that the goal-based outcome tool will produce. They want to see progress or lack of progress, and they want to have a conversation with the practitioner about what does this mean. So sharing the data back to the young person in the form of charts, if that fits with the young person, it fits with the therapist, it has to be it's a clinical judgment. These are clinical tools, but I think the default should be you do share the information unless there's a good reason not to, rather than the other way around, which I think historically we've kind of kept things a bit of a secret. I think it's really helpful in supervision. So for supervisors, not just with a goal-based outcome tool, but with other feedback and outcomes tools or clinical measures, to be able to hear or to see what the young person feels about the work. It's a filtered way. It's filtered through a questionnaire, but rather than being filtered through the therapist, either way it's filtered, but it opens up another channel of communication that can be helpful for supervisors to get a view of, okay, this looks like a case that is heading in the right direction, or this looks like one where we've seen no change for a few weeks. Those are the ones that need to be brought to supervision, because there's a chance that person might drop out from therapy. We know that if you don't get early change in a therapeutic encounter, then the person's much more likely to drop out.
So what happens if the young person gets stuck in some way? What happens in terms of those goals being fulfilled? How flexible is it? Or do the goals get changed? Can you tweak them?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people say, I don't like this tool because if a young person isn't making any change, then that's really difficult. But the tool doesn't create the lack of change. The tool makes it more explicit that there is no change. And then you can have a conversation about that. So, okay, we've been meeting for 4 weeks now. We've made no progress towards your goals, the things that you said you wanted help with. What it does is it flags this as a time to have a kind of conversation about that. Is it that I'm not being very helpful as a therapist? Is it that there's stuff going on out there in your world which is kind of preventing you from making progress, and then what might need to change out there? Or is it that these are just not the right goals, that they're too ambitious, or that they look right when we first met, but now they're not? So clinically, you do whatever you would. So if you feel you need to work on something different, then you work on something different. And if it's helpful to track those new goals in therapy, then do that. The problem comes when we're trying to collect data at a national level, because if you're changing kind of goals and starting to collect things, you're starting and stopping at different places, then it kind of makes the data messy. But my view is the data in child mental health services about outcomes is so appallingly bad. The national data we hold about whether child mental health services are effective or not is so bad that I would rather people did something which was useful and collecting some data which we can then start to improve on, rather than saying, oh, well, it's all a bit difficult, so we won't do it, or we won't capture it, or we won't measure it. I think we have to get better at knowing whether what we do is really effective with real young people in real child mental health services, not just what research evidence tells us. Both are important, but we've got to know whether it really works on the ground with the young people being seen across the country.
I'm wondering, there was something you said about the need to collect good data, and I'm wondering if there's ever a conflict between the wider goal of ensuring that the outcome data can be used and analysed on a wider basis, and actually what's clinically best for the child, or whether those two are always in alignment, in your view?
It'd be nice to think they were always in alignment, but I think they're not. And I think that what might be useful to know at a national level and what is practical and clinically meaningful to gather in therapy sessions, I think, there is times where there's conflict. So my view is, and this is held by others, that what we should do, I see these as clinical tools. Mm. So these are tools which help us do our job better if they're used well. And by used well, I mean that they're kind of, they make sense to the therapist, they make sense to the young person, they understand what the data is that they're collecting and how it will be used, and there's some conversation around that. They're not used apologetically. So when we speak to young people and say, you know, in terms of using these kind of, any kind of measures, goal-based outcome tool, whatever, what's the one thing that therapists can do which will make it more meaningful for you and more helpful for young people to complete it? And they say, tell them not to be apologetic. Because what therapists do, we know, is that where it's not used meaningfully, they'll say to the person, okay, we're going to do this therapy stuff, but I'm afraid before we start doing it, here are some tools that I need you to kind of complete. The message is, they're of no value to me, they're of no value to you, we're never going to look at them again. And what happens is that young people complete them, remarkably. They don't screw them up and throw them back in the therapist's face, which perhaps they should. But they'll complete them, but we know that they'll complete them really quickly, or they won't complete them very kind of thoughtfully. But that data then gets into a national database, becomes a big data, and decisions will be made in the future on that data. Whereas if we explain to young people what this tool is, how it can be useful to them, how it can be useful to therapists, how they'll use it together, and I think that requires negotiation, then the young person will complete the tool in a more thoughtful way. The data will be better. The data going into the big data sets will be more accurate. And whatever decisions are made down the line with this will be more informed. The data will still be messy. Mm-hmm. But my view is that we use it clinically first, and the data is a really helpful byproduct of that, rather than other programs where they've gone for the data is paramount, and sometimes it'll get in the way of the clinical work, but actually what we get is really good data. I think it's a matter of judgment. I would prefer to go with the clinically meaningful first, data is mm-hmm. a helpful byproduct rather than the other way around. But
do you think if a clinician is working with goal-based outcomes, will it influence their practice? Will interventions be put into place that focus on the achievement of the goals? Which might be a good thing, I don't know.
I hope it changes practice, because that's mm-hmm. the point. Right. So if people just do it and don't do anything differently as a result of having a conversation mm-hmm. with a young person about what they want or whether they feel you're being helpful or not, then there is no point. So I hope it does change practice, because that's the idea of it. Whether it makes the whole system more outcomes focused in that you've got to get better, mm-hmm. Then that's a concern. So we know some young people feel that, I think, whether using goal-based outcome tool or not, that they feel responsible for getting better themselves, which to a point is true. You know, the way psychological therapies work is that you have to be motivated to make some change. But often young people feel overly responsible, and we make them feel overly responsible by saying, you as an individual, go and meet that other individual and you'll do something and you'll get better, and then you can kind of get on with your life. I think it puts way too much pressure on young people. There's some colleagues up in the northwest, so a psychologist, Vicky Eames, and colleagues have come up with what they call team goals. So they, when they're setting goals with young people, they have an explicit conversation about who will help you achieve this goal. So it's not your sole responsibility. You're part of a team, and that team around you will work towards your goal. So if you're not making progress, it's the team that's not kind of functioning properly, rather than it being your kind of fault, in inverted commas. I think it's a really nice way of kind of taking the pressure off young people. we also need to be realistic about what kind of outcomes we can expect in therapy. So I think there's a really strong myth in child mental health that everyone can get better. All you have to do is kind of work harder or be more motivated or throw more resource at the young person, see them 5 times a week rather than once a fortnight, throw in a bit of medication and a bit of family therapy, and eventually you'll get the combination right and the young person will get better. The evidence to support that is very scant indeed. In fact, the evidence kind of supports the opposite view, which is for a lot of young people, we are not sophisticated enough yet to get them as well as they would want to be. Partly because we kind of make change and then we're putting them back into society where the problems that created the mental health problems in the first place are still there. So, of course, they continue unless we change the environment. The recovery rates, which I think are the things that we need to have some really kind of honest conversations about. So the best data we've got in terms of real child mental health data from England suggests that about a third of young people recover. So come in with a problem and describe themselves as leaving, and the problem is sufficiently reduced that it's not having a significant impact on their life. Only a third. So two-thirds continue with, even if they've been provided the best help, still continue with a sort of ongoing problem. Mm-hmm. And I think by collecting national data, we can start having honest conversations about that. If that drives people to feel, well, I hope it'll do two things. It might stop this myth of everyone must get better. So if you're not reaching your goals, then that's a problem. Mm-hmm. It might take the pressure off to say, well, actually, the problems that you're coming with are really difficult. So difficult that, perhaps there's nobody who has the answer to the problem. But we might be able to help you move a little way. We might be able to help you. Or we might say, well, actually, it's something else that needs to change. Therapy is not the thing that's helpful for you. There are other things in your life which might be more helpful than what we can offer here.
Might it also drive resources change? Is that part of the aim as well in the outcome, to get a much more realistic sense of positive outcomes?
Well, my wish is that it drives more resource into child mental health. So there have been really good changes recently. The media coverage of child mental health difficulties is kind of, I've seen charts which show an absolute exponential rise in coverage around child mental health. This suggests that the taboos are starting to shift. I think from young people themselves, the taboo of mental health is much weaker than it is in certainly people of my generation, mm-hmm. where it was absolutely unspoken about. And I think if we can kind of shift those taboos, if we can get it in the political agenda, if we can flag this massive lack of resource that's in child mental health service, and also if we can start thinking around child mental health in a different way. So not thinking about we wait till there's a problem and then we treat it, mm-hmm. but if we start thinking about what is it in children's environments which create or make it more likely that young people develop mental health problems, how can we get rid of those environmental influences or reduce them? Or how can we mitigate against the impact of them and not putting the responsibility on children? So it is about resilience, but I really become quite anxious when I hear about schools saying we're building individual resilience in our children. So the Duckworth's view of grit, this idea that was picked up by the Department for Education a little while ago, that it completely negates any responsibility of the school or the system or society from causing or doing things which are more likely to lead to mental health problems, and puts all the responsibility on the young person. Yeah, I think that's an appalling state of affairs. So we need to think about how we deliver systems, how we think about mental health interventions, that we move away from the idea of therapy as being the only way to intervene. I think those are we'll use the resource much better. We'll be creating much less distress of young people and kind of try and turn the tide of this, what seems to be an ever increasing demand for mental health services. Mm. I'd like to see there being a reduction in demand for mental health services because it's seen that there are, you know, they have their importance. They will still be very, very, there will not be a time when we don't need them, but we're doing stuff which is much more helpful, much more broader view of psychological interventions.
Right. I just want to come back to your goal-based outcomes tool, because I wanted to ask you how it's been evaluated and whether there are any sort of interim findings that you can share. Yeah.
The tool itself, there's an RCT starting in Canada later this month, and that will be the first test of the tool itself. But in terms of research around the value of goals, there's quite a lot of evidence, and we invited an American colleague, Georgiana Schick Tryon, to do a review of the literature for us about the value of goals across adult and child mental health services. And there she summarised into a really nice chapter in our book, Working with Goals in Psychotherapy and Counselling.
Can you say anything about the findings? Or
when I'm presenting on this, I might even use this. I'll be giving away my too many secrets about the presentation in December, but I present the research findings and then I do a bit of mind reading and read the mind of the delegates to see what they think about the research evidence, because it kind of raises a few eyebrows, because the things it says are things like, okay, it's important to set goals, it's important that they're collaborative, but what the research evidence says is if you've got agreement between the parent, the child and the therapist about the goal, you're much likely to get better outcomes. Right. And actually in real-world child mental health settings, that's a pretty difficult thing to do. The other thing it says is around the kinds of goals that are helpful. So approach goals are better than avoidance goals. So avoidance goals are things that you don't want to happen. So I don't want to be lonely, or I don't want to feel anxious, or I don't want to be bullied. Those are all avoidance goals. Approach goals would be things like, I want to have more friends, I want to feel happier, you know, things that are change-orientated and future-orientated. We know these are things that are more helpful. And interestingly, the literature says that if you actually, it's not about having conversations about goals, but if you actually write them down and monitor them, so this wasn't a test of the GBO, but it's a test of, there are other tools that do similar things, that actually if you write them down and monitor them, monitor the progress, then also you're more likely to get better outcomes.
How often with the goal-based outcomes tool, how often do you revisit the goals then with the child while it's in progress?
As often as is helpful, which is a bit of a kind of, you know, cop-out.
But so it's tailored to each?
Yeah, I think it has to be tailored. So my default position in my work is that I would ask about goals every session, unless there's a good reason not to. Mm-hmm. But people that I've worked with over the years will say, he doesn't ask us every session, and that's because it's not always helpful to do that. So if you're not seeing much change, if you're not hearing about much change, actually asking someone to rate their goals every week when you know that there's not change might reinforce the idea that there's not much change. Mm-hmm. I mean, even saying that, that might be helpful to have conversations about more regularly about, is this helpful? Are we doing the right things? But you might make a clinical judgment, and I would, that actually, you know, we might do it every other session rather than every session, because actually doing it every session might just be reinforcing a negative, it's reducing hope rather than kind of instilling hope, which is, so it's a clinical judgment. It has to fit with the way you work, the way the person works, but certainly doing it frequently, and a default is every session unless there's a helpful clinical reason not to.
Are there any new developments in the pipeline regarding how the goal-based outcomes tool might be used? So, for example, in different types of settings or with specific client groups?
Yes, and I think, I mean, other people are already using things like it. So I'm not pretending that this is a kind of, you know, genius innovation. It's just a very straightforward, practical, helpful way of doing something which is useful therapeutically. People are really picking up on the ideas behind it, and that's the important bit. It's a deceptively simple tool, but the ideas behind it are the bit that makes it really valuable. So I've had people contacting me recently from physical health settings. So we're doing a piece of work at the moment with Great Ormond Street in their palliative care setting. And I think this is really fascinating about not only how do you set goals in a palliative care setting, but what are the sorts of goals and how do you monitor them? How do you have collaborative conversations in that kind of arena? But they are being extremely thoughtful about how to do this, and it's a kind of a real privilege to be working with them. And also, last week, Alderhay Hospital got in touch and said, actually, we're thinking about having a kind of global measure in our physical health settings. And I think, you know, they're picking up on the most important thing to measure is the thing that's most important to the family, not what we as practitioners feel we ought to be seeing, but what the family really want. So those are sort of interesting new developments.
You already touched on some of the things you're going to be talking about in November. Can you give a brief summary of some of the other areas without...
Apart from the mind readings, I'm going to be doing some mind reading. I want to set out the ideas behind the tool. So I'd say the tool is deceptively simple, it's just 0 to 10, but I want to set out the kind of complex clinical practice, very sophisticated clinical practice that goes into even being able to agree a goal with a young person and then to monitor it. And the other thing I like to do, although it's difficult in a big lecture theatre, is usually what I do at the start of, if I'm doing a training workshop, is I'll ask people what they want to get from the training workshop, and then I'll tailor what I talk about to what people want. It's, you know, it's not surprising, it kind of models the kind of goal setting approach. It'll be interesting, it'll change people's lives, but I can't quite say in what way yet.
Is there anything you want to add that I haven't asked?
Well, I should do a shameless publicity about my book that Mick Cooper and I wrote that was out earlier this year, came out on my birthday, in fact, which is called Working with Goals in Psychotherapy and Counselling, which is not surprisingly about working with goals in psychotherapy and counselling. And what we did was we invited, so Mick and I wrote some of the chapters, some independently, some together, but we invited other people to write about their experience of using goals from their perspective, including people with lived experience of mental health services. We thought it was really important to get their perspective on things. And we also got people to talk from different therapeutic perspectives about how goals fit with their way of working. And there's a chapter around different goals tools and how they might be used and the philosophy of goals and the psychology of goals. It's a very good read, £30 from all good bookshops. You can find more information about the book and other things around goals and the GBO, and you can download the tool for free at www.goals-in-therapy.com. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Duncan Law.
What is your sort of take-home message for listeners of this podcast?
Listen to what young people have to tell us and be receptive to what young people and families have to say, because what they have to say is really helpful for us to be helpful back. And if the goal-based outcome tool can help us have those conversations, then great, it's serving its purpose, and I'm a very happy man.
Brilliant, thank you ever so much. Dr. Duncan Law will be speaking at the inaugural Judy Dunn National Conference on Making Child and Family Therapies More Effective, which takes place on November the 9th in Manchester, and through the live stream. You can find details on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and on Twitter, at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.